All right, Kevin, let's fix a hole here, huh? 3, 2, 1. Hey, it's Elton Jim Toronto, and this is Captain Podtastic. And welcome to another episode of Elton Jim Toronto's Captain Podtastic. Right here at WGNplus.com. Every Monday, a new episode is posted at WGNplus.com. Episode 55 today. And it is going to be a pepper of a podcast as we celebrate the 50th anniversary of the release of what some consider the greatest rock album of all time. There's actually some debate about that in the last several years, but it has pretty much been considered the greatest album of all time. The Beatles, Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, released in 1967. Now, what's interesting, I have always read that it was released on June 1st, 1967. As I have been doing some research and reading many articles over the last several weeks about the album, I have seen different dates mentioned. I have seen May 26th. I have seen June 2nd. I have seen June 1st in England, June 2nd in the United States. But I'm staying with June 1st. That's what I've always seen. And so June 1st, 1967 is the day that Sergeant Pepper's, and we should say that, yes, there is an apostrophe there. So Sergeant Pepper, right off the bat, we need to make sure that we understand that. It is Sergeant Pepper and his Lonely Hearts Club Band. His last name isn't Peppers or Puppers. As you say over there in Elmwood Park over there, I'll have a beef with Puppers. No, it's Peppers, but it's Pepper. Sergeant Pepper's, apostrophe S, Lonely Hearts Club Band. Now, I mean, if you're younger, you might be saying, what's the big deal? I mean, first of all, it seems this year, and we're going to be seeing a lot of this over the next several years, as the baby boomers continue to take a stroll down memory lane. We're going to have a lot of 50th anniversaries for the next 10 years because it was since 1964 when the Beatles first hit and the baby boomer generation really began to take hold. It was very much, to some extent, like the millennial generation now. The only difference is that there is a completely different angle and perspective about a younger generation in the mass media than there was 50 years ago. 50 years ago, the rock world, the pop culture world, was still viewed as a very fad, small thing. The what we call now the greatest generation, or the generation of that time, was not geared toward youth. It was geared toward the 35 or 40 or 50 year old, and they had been running things for several years. And whatever teenagers were into, or even people in their 20s were into, wasn't given much notice at all, certainly not importance, but not much even notice in the media. Now, 50 years later, that is completely shifted. And the media is consumed with what 13-year-old and 14-year-old boys and girls like and what the cool trend is. And you see people in their 40s and 50s embarrassingly talking about, ooh, look at what's trending. You know, ooh, look at this emoji. You know, 50 years ago, if there was a such thing as an emoji, we never would have known it. Because the media of the day, the editors of TV stations and the editors of newspapers, would never have given an emoji the time of day. It wasn't important. I had to laugh. I was going through some of these old bins that I have of some of my mom's stuff. I was talking about this a couple of weeks ago. And I'm telling you, September 1st, I'm getting rid of all this stuff one way or the other. So over the last weekend, we were going through the bins and throwing some stuff out again and organizing things. And to go to show you how old some of this stuff has my mom kept, some of it was wrapped in a newspaper from 1959. It was, the newspaper wasn't even yellow. It was orange. That's how old it was. I kept it. I couldn't throw it out. 1959. There was I was reading the paper. It was still in fairly good shape, although it was kind of crumbling at times. But just to read the stories from 1959, there was a story here that said that this is a little history lesson. We all know about Fidel Castro and Cuba and, you know, the communist regime, which is still going on in Cuba. What you have to remember is Castro took over Cuba as a rebel, not as a communist initially. He was viewed as a freedom fighter because there was a dictator. We actually were supporting Castro initially. So he wasn't a communist right away. And interestingly enough, there's this little story in the paper from 1959, and it says, from some government official, says, it looks like Cuba and Castro might become communist, or as they say in the headline, Cuba might be going red. I'm like, you can't even write that stuff anymore. So anyway, why is Sergeant Pepper so important? First of all, on its face, it is a very good album. Is it the greatest album of all time? Is it a collection of the best Beatles songs ever written? Is it a collection of the best songs ever written in quote unquote the rock era, if you will, especially from this era, from say the 60s on? That's debatable. It certainly is one of the best Beatles albums. It was their eighth album, and it certainly came at a time when it was a milestone in what it represented. What is so great about Sgt. Pepper is that it was timely for its time when it came out in 1967, and it is now timeless, meaning that it does go on, and it is a landmark and milestone album. But to really appreciate why there's such a fuss, now I've got Kevin in here, he's 30-some years old. He's a music guy. You co-host that show, Sound Session, so yep. You're a music guy.
Oh, yeah.
Now, what is your take on Sgt. Pepper? As a 30-year-old, is it what's much ado about nothing, or what's the big deal, or why are you making such a big deal? Why don't you have Emily on today for Pop Culture Club to talk about something interesting? Why are you going to talk about the whole show about Sgt. Pepper? Or are you saying, you mean you're only going to do 1 hour on Sgt. Pepper? It's the greatest album of all time. Or do you fall somewhere in the middle?
I'm somewhere in the middle for sure. I'm of the belief that, you know, and it's controversial. I don't think that the Beatles are necessarily the best band of all time. I think they're up there. They're absolutely up there.
Who would you say?
I'd go Zeppelin, personally.
Above the Beatles?
Yes.
What I love about Kevin is he certainly knows his music, and that's a valid and interesting, and you know, it's controversial. There's no problem with that. But what is so funny is when you talk to someone, and I was in the same situation when I was a younger person, looking back and talking to someone older who had experienced things of the at the moment when it happened, as opposed to finding it later.
Right.
Because that is a huge determining factor. Now, I was 3 years old when Sgt. Pepper came out, so I have no remembrance of this. I mean, I'm still, you know, I'm late to the parade on it, right? I mean, I'm post Beatles, to be honest with you. You know, I didn't even have any brothers or sisters, so I didn't have someone that sort of. If you ever saw the great movie Almost Famous, mm-hmm. Did you ever see that movie?
Yeah.
Where his sister is moving away, and right. she gives him this whole rack of albums, and she's like, okay, these albums,
right.
You have to listen to, because this is what it's going to teach you about life here. Right. In fact, when my godson turned 16, that's what I did for him. I bought him like 30, at the time, CDs, because that was the thing. But I bought him like 30 CDs, and I said, okay, these 30 CDs, I don't care what you listen to, I don't care what you like, but every record collection needs these 30 CDs.
Sure.
By these bands. And Sgt. Pepper was in there. But so, you know, when, by the time I became aware of music, say when I was born in 64, so by the time I became aware of music, the Beatles had broken up in 1970. So, I mean, I was 73, 74, you know, they weren't a band anymore.
Right.
So I'm listening to the radio and I'm hearing songs by this guy named Paul McCartney and this guy named John Lennon and this guy named Ringo Starr and this guy named George Harrison. And I'm hearing John, Paul, George, and Ringo. I mean, they were still in the zeitgeist. They were still hoping that there were hopes they would get back together. But in terms of having the music there and accessible, it wasn't on Top 40 radio because the hits of the day were on Top 40 radio and there were no Beatles hits. So I really came to really learn about the Beatles much later. I would say by the late 70s. There was a compilation album called Rock and Roll Music that was put out in about 76. And that was just it was kind of a greatest hits of songs that were never released as singles. And so they were trying to, you know, sort of pump up the Beatles catalog again. And if Beatles fans certainly know that once they broke up, there were two double albums of greatest hits. There's this Red album that went from like 63 to 67. And then there was a Blue album that went from 67 to 70, double album of all their greatest hits. And that's pretty much how I learned about it. But in terms of albums and deep tracks and album cuts, I wasn't really, you know, exposed to that because I wasn't around when these albums came out. So similar to like you, I was all, you know, I heard about the Beatles.
Right.
But I never, you know, until I really started to dig in and listen to the albums and went, oh, all right, I get it now. But I'm in a similar situation to some extent. I mean, we have a 20-year age difference, but I was still coming at the Beatles long after Beatlemania, mm-hmm. just like you are. And so I wouldn't have said the Beatles were the greatest band either. Because I had, you know, obviously I'm an Elton John fan, but I mean, just listening to other music, I would have said, oh yeah, the Beatles are good. There's no doubt. Don't get me wrong. But I didn't have like a rabid Beatle brother.
Same, actually, yeah.
To tell me how great they were and force feed me Beatles.
Right.
Because I remember in grammar school, there was this one kid who was, you know, like in sixth or seventh grade, he was like, you know, ooh, you know, Greg is a big Beatle fan. But he was a Beatle fan because he had like five brothers and sisters who were younger, who were older than him. And they were, so he, but we would have this, like Fridays, you know, art class. You could bring in your favorite albums, you know, and then we would play them while we were drawing and everything. And he would always bring in Beatle albums. And that was another area where I was like, I heard about these albums. I never really saw them. I didn't have them. Because like I said, I was listening to Top 40, what was on the radio at the time. It really wasn't until album rock became popular in the late 70s, where radio stations were actually beginning to play deep cuts or album cuts that were not the ones that were released as singles. And they were, so now all of a sudden they were playing songs and they were talking about the albums as opposed to just the hits. So that's interesting. You think that Led Zeppelin is better than the Beatles?
Yeah, I think I do.
Yeah. I had a laugh one time listening to the. I'll never let you forget this. So,
is this Chicago?
Yeah. So I'm listening to Bill and Wendy's show, and Kevin is the producer, and they always have him on talking in the discussion. They were, and this is a couple of years ago, and they were talking about the rock and roll induction, and the induction hadn't happened yet. The votes hadn't happened. They just announced the potential inductees, and after a long and debate, there was this thing about Chicago having never been in there. And so there was the whole list of these potential people that were up for nomination. And Chicago was up. And so Bill and Wendy and Kevin were kind of discussing who should get in. And Bill and Wendy are are basically my age, I would say. And so I was pretty much tracking with what they were saying. And then Kevin came in. So they said, okay, well, you know, Chicago or the Cars? And Kevin goes, Cars?
Yep.
Without a doubt.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, I heard the whole city groan. in their cars. But it was so funny because, once again, your exposure to Chicago is probably purer in that you're listening to the music. You're not being influenced by, oh my gosh, I remember the summer of 72 mm-hmm. when that was on the radio or whatever. And so much of what we enjoy and what we like is not just the quality of the music, but it's also the context of the music.
Right, that makes sense.
When we heard it, what memories it brings back for us, and that plays into it. And it plays into my discussion here because context, when you look at Sgt. Pepper, is huge. The reason that this album, 50 years later, is being made such a big deal about is because, first of all, in 1967, you had this growing subculture of, as I said, of the baby boomers beginning to take, they were coming of age, they're teenagers in their 20s, and don't forget, there's a Vietnam War. So for a lot of people, don't forget, there is something called a draft. I mean, we have a volunteer army, but there were young people, mostly men at that time, teenagers, really, 18 years old, who were being drafted into this war where no one even knew what the heck or why we were going into it. I mean, that was a life changer. You know, today, in today's world, if you want to join the military, you certainly know the risks going in, but it's your choice. This was, hey, what if I want to be this when I grow up? Well, suddenly the government sends you a letter and says, well, I don't know what you want to be when you grow up, but for right now, you're going to be a soldier. And you're going overseas, and you're probably going to get killed. So there was this generation that was not only coming of age in terms of pure numbers to have an influence on our society, but there was also a vested interest. These weren't just you know, people protesting for the sake of protesting. They wanted an end to a Vietnam War because it severely and seriously could have and did impact their lives at the moment as well as their futures. They didn't have a vested interest in that war, but they certainly had a vested interest in being drafted. And you could say, well, you know, they drafted people in World War II, right? But you know what? We were attacked at Pearl Harbor, and there was a definitive menace called Adolf Hitler that needed to be stopped. But in the 60s, there was this subculture of the baby boomers coming of age. Not only were they in big numbers, but they were rebellious. Especially American society was still very conservative. There was right and wrong. There was no gray areas in anything. And people were expected to do and live a certain way. And kids were expected to grow up a certain way. And so what the Beatles, or it started with Elvis, but what the Beatles really began in 1964 was not just a musical revolution, but it really was a cultural revolution. I mean, it's funny now to look at the Beatles on Ed Sullivan and say, and think that they were considered having long hair. That was long hair back then. Because everybody those days had what most people have today. What's that, full slide? What do they call that? Were they
like high and tight or something?
Yeah,
like
whatever
that?
That's called. I mean, everybody had real short hair, almost a buzz cut. So the Beatles looked like ragged dogs. But today, if you look at the Beatles in 1964 on the Ed Sullivan Show, they look downright natty and proper. But they were considered rogues. That's how conservative things were. So in 1967, you had this bubbling counterculture of young people, and then you had the introduction of drugs. And you also had you know, a lot more, you know, I guess thinking out of the box, even though it wasn't a phrase back then. But there was a lot more interest in Eastern philosophies, and the way things used to be and all the rules were suddenly beginning to be questioned by this younger generation. And so why Sergeant Pepper was such a big deal, and the people that did listen to it, who did buy it and remember exactly where they were when they listened to it, and they listened to it for hours, and why it was so life-changing for many people was because it was kind of a validation. The Beatles really did move the culture in many ways, but what Sergeant Pepper did was validate what was happening with the youth culture in the mainstream. Up until then, it was still kind of viewed as, it's just teenage whatever, and they'll grow out of it. But when Sergeant Pepper came out, the reason why things changed was suddenly, you got to remember, 1966, the Beatles decided to stop touring. And they had been out of the public eye for a good 6 or 8 months. Now that, you may say, well, what's the big deal? Back then, that was a big deal because they were putting out albums in their heyday every 6 months. New albums. They were touring constantly. They were always around. So for the Beatles to be gone for 6 or 7 months, at that time, was an eternity. And the last time that the majority of people, the mainstream people, saw the Beatles, they were still the Beatles. They were still wearing the same clothes. They still had their hair. Their hair was, they were beginning to get a little raggedy, though. If you look at some of the pictures from one of their final concerts at Shea Stadium, they were still bowing all together at the same time like they did, and they all wearing the same thing, but their hair was a little raggedy. Their clothes were a little raggedy. They didn't have the ties perfectly straight. You could see they were getting restless. And there was and that restlessness was happening with the youth of America. There was a restlessness going on because society was so tight and conservative. And there was a new day coming. And so the Beatles had not been heard of for about 6 or 8 months. When the Beatles came out with Sgt. Pepper, there was a lot of shock. The pictures, first of all the Beatles had mustaches. Whoa. Facial hair? What's that? No one had facial hair. Everyone was clean shaven. But you know who had facial hair? The hippies. But you know what? They were kind of on the fringes, and you'd see them hanging around, and you know they weren't, you know, anything to care about, and they were looked at as kind of the dregs of society, and they're never going to be amount to anything. Well, suddenly, the most influential band and the most influential personalities in the culture looked like those guys and those gals who were supposedly the lost generation, the dregs. They weren't going to be successful. The Beatles looked like them. Every Beatle had a mustache. You say, what's the big deal? It was a big deal because that was, as much as you want to say it's crazy, facial hair was a sign of rebellion back then because everybody was so clean cut. In fact, the first two songs that would have and should have been on Sgt. Pepper, Penny Lane and Strawberry Fields Forever, were recorded and were supposed to be on Sgt. Pepper. But because the Beatles had been out of circulation for so long, Capitol Records said, look, you're going to release this album in June, but we can't wait almost a year until some Beatles product is out. So give us a couple of songs to just release to the radio stations to make sure that people still remember the Beatles. And so they gave them Penny Lane and Strawberry Fields Forever as a double-sided single, so the radio could actually play both songs. And because they had been released in February of 67, as opposed to later when the album came out, then they decided not to put those two songs on the album. And to be honest with you, as good as Sgt. Pepper is, if Penny Lane and Strawberry Fields were on Sgt. Pepper, I think it's a stronger album. Those are two great songs. But what really did, especially Strawberry Fields, I mean, don't forget, the last time we heard the Beatles, while Revolver was beginning to get a little more adventurous and a little more psychedelic, and the Beatles definitely had begun to experiment with drugs, and certainly in their personal lives, as well as writing songs about the feeling and the psychedelia and the trippiness and all that, it really came full circle on Sgt. Pepper. When you listen to Strawberry Fields, the music, the production, the surreal kind of lyrics, it's very far away from "She Loves You, Yeah, Yeah, Yeah." It's very different. And what's also interesting about those two songs is that you often hear about Paul McCartney and John Lennon as both individual writers as well as a songwriting team. And as many people may or may not know, even if they wrote a song individually, they still credited both of them on all the Beatles songs. So even if, for instance, pretty much they could take a song like Yesterday, which Paul McCartney pretty much wrote all himself and did everything by himself, John Lennon's name is still on there. And it was agreed when they started writing that it would be Lennon and McCartney. It just went alphabetically. In fact, you may remember about 5 or 10 years ago, Paul McCartney asked Yoko just for the song Yesterday, could we switch the names on the credit? It wouldn't change anything in terms of the royalties, but every Beatles composition, whether it was written together by the two or individually, was listed, unless it was George Harrison or Ringo Starr. But if it was either Paul or John, they shared the writing credit, even if they did it individually. And so Paul wanted Yesterday, which has become his signature song pretty much, to reflect that it was his song. And Yoko said, no way. It's staying Lennon McCartney. You guys, that's what John and you agreed. And John's not here to change that. And I'm not going to change it. And so that's how important that kind of was. But what's so interesting, you always hear about McCartney is kind of the melodic guy, and Lennon was the kind of acerbic and rougher kind of lyricist in his melodies, and McCartney's are mostly lighter and love songs and bouncy and jumpy and, you know, Lady Madonna and, you know, Michelle, things like that. And meanwhile, you know, Lennon's talking about being a nowhere man. But that's what made the songwriting team so great, was because they played off each other. And you could really see the difference. Everybody, they try to downplay that. And I think they try to rewrite history. But I really believe that if you listen to the Beatles music closely, you will see how, especially listen to their solo stuff. Most Paul McCartney solo music is light and bouncy and very melodic. And most John Lennon solo stuff is much simpler melodically. He was a good musician, but he wasn't a great musician. Paul McCartney is, whatever you want to say about Paul McCartney, amazing musician. I mean, I think the guy literally is born with melodies in his blood. Now, you could say that's good or bad. I mean, his music is certainly more pop-oriented as opposed to Lennon stuff. But when you look at those two songs that came out, clearly they had an idea. The all idea, you know, Penny Lane is an area in Liverpool. And Strawberry Fields is also an area in Liverpool. It's kind of an orphanage. I've been there. It's pretty cool. I mean, it's really not much there, but there is a wall there that says Strawberry Fields, and everybody goes there, and you look in there. But it was kind of an orphanage. But that's where John sort of played around in that area. But here's the thing. When you look at those two songs, Penny Lane is this light, airy, melodic, nostalgic story. It's very literal. McCartney points to the barber and the fireman, and this guy doesn't wear a coat, and it's very literal. And when you go to Liverpool, You go to where Penny Lane is, and all that stuff is still there, or at least the buildings are. So it's very literal and very accessible. And then look at Strawberry Fields. It's about an orphanage, but it's about a state of mind. Let me take you down, because I'm going to Strawberry Fields. Nothing is real. What the heck is he talking about? So that's my point. There's the difference. Same idea. Let's write a song about where we grew up. Paul McCartney writes a nice, jumpy, nostalgic song about growing up in Liverpool. And John Lennon writes a song that's about his growing up, but he just uses that growing up as a kickoff point for some deeper meanings or some questions, or more than anything else, almost an abstract or mood. He's creating a mood about what Strawberry Fields is. Strawberry Fields Forever, what does that mean? Well, we could still debate that. So those two songs really show the difference in the McCartney and the Lennon songwriting thing, but what also shows is where the Beatles were moving in 1967 with Sgt. Pepper. And so when Sgt. Pepper, as I said, when it came out, you have to really listen to it, and it's not easy. But what you really need to do to really appreciate this as an album and why people are making such a big deal about it is because you have to go back and research what was going on in the world in 1967. Because this album is an album of its time. And when you understand what the norms were in 1967, then you realize why this album, to quote a phrase I keep hearing a lot these days, why this album was so disruptive. That's the big business word now I hear on all these entrepreneurial shows. Oh, you got to be disruptive. Okay, well, Sgt. Pepper was pretty disruptive because it was giving a voice and giving a face and giving a validation to this growing youth culture that we have seen over the last 50 years has pretty much dominated, until the last 10, has dominated our culture. Once again, because of sheer numbers, the baby boomer generation has moved this culture. You can debate whether it's good or bad, but you can't debate whether they moved it or not. And so Sgt. Pepper was, first of all, a band, the Beatles, of them, of their generation, of their age group. Most people at the time were Beatle fans. They looked up to the Beatles. They idolized them. They dressed like them. They followed them. And so when the Beatles come out with mustaches and psychedelia outfits and this kind of different aspect of music, it changes everything. And what's really interesting is that there are so many aspects. As I said, you could debate many of the songs. What's interesting about this album is it also, once again, we know about the concept album per se. You have to remember, if you didn't know, for the most part, the way albums were put together, they weren't considered entire entities of creating a mood or maybe telling a story. They were considered, there's 10 songs for people to listen to. Most likely, out of those 10, we'll find two good ones. We'll put those on the radio, and we will sell the 7-inch single, and we will sell the album. And so an album was just 10, most of the time, 10 disjointed songs. There was nothing the same about them. There was no overall theme about them. There was nothing connecting them together. They were just 10 individual songs, and we'll pick the two best ones, and off we go. And so Sgt. Pepper is actually credited as being one of the first, if you will, concept albums. Now, later on, a couple years later, we've got Tommy, for instance, by The Who, which is the first rock opera, but it tells a story. The fact is, there is no Tommy without Sgt. Pepper. Because this whole idea that an album of 10 or 11 or 9 songs could actually be interconnected and not even necessarily in themes about the songs, but in just a vibe or a feeling or a sound. And that was, and in this case, there really is a loose kind of concept going on. As I said, the Beatles in 1966 quit touring. Beatlemania, they had it up to here. They were selling out everywhere, but they were very frustrated. They couldn't even hear each other play. And back then, I mean, they were playing baseball stadiums with speakers that you have bigger speakers in your house right now. So it was just mostly a chance for girls to scream and see the Beatles. So they got tired of that. And so when they decided to record, they decided to just become a studio band. They're just going to become a studio. They're not going to tour anymore. And so they were so fed up with being the Beatles at that point that the whole idea was, I guess in McCartney's mind, was, well, what if we made this new album as a pseudo band? Let's not be the Beatles. And he came up with this idea of Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, because at the time there were a lot of, you know, Country Joe and the Fish, and there was a lot of goofy names for bands. And so he was just trying to think of some crazy name that he could come up with. And so he actually said to them, to the Beatles, I've got this idea. I'm coming up with a song idea, but what if we put this new album out? And the whole idea was that we're not the Beatles, that this album is by Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, whoever they are. And it will give us a freedom. We don't have to sing 2 or 3 minute songs about She Loves You, I Saw Her Standing There, because we're not the Beatles now. That expectation is gone. We're going to make music for this band called Sgt. Pepper, and they could do anything they want. And that's the way the mindset was of, we can begin to experiment even more than we did on Revolver. And we could start to use different instruments, and we could actually make this like it's a mini performance. Play that first song there, would you, Kevin? And so when the album starts, this is what you hear. Okay, that's like an orchestra pit. So you're at a performance, and here's the song that introduces them. And so when the album starts, it's the Beatles, but it really isn't. Because as he says right here, and all this, and in this, and this clapping and laughing. Now you got to remember, we look back at this now and we say, why are you making such a big deal about this, Jim? Because that on a record album and on a song, the idea of even putting in some kind of sound effects to sweeten this or tell some kind of story was unheard of at the time. And so people are listening to this and they're like, whoa, what is this? And so if you put yourself back in that time period, it's a new Beatles album, and this is certainly not what you expected a new Beatles song to sound like, or a new Beatles album. And so then as this song continues, you know, then all of a sudden, you know, Paul introduces a singer in the band named Billy Shears, and it's Ringo. And then, of course, you know, he sings, you know, keep playing that one or no? Yeah. So, okay. So now we've got this guy named Billy Shears, who is a member of Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. And people are clapping for him. And so you're listening to this and going, what the heck are the Beatles doing? And then you go, well, wait a minute. That's not Billy Shears. That's Ringo. And suddenly you start to get the sense of what the Beatles are trying to do here. They're not just putting out 10 songs on an album. They've got this concept, and they're going along with it. Now, the concept isn't tight and strict. The songs come and go, and there are some songs that are very straightforward, and there's some that are a little more adventurous and experimental. But that's what was so different, is that they were taking the album and they were literally flipping it on its side of what an album used to mean. Now you wanted to put, everybody talks about vinyl today, how you put the needle on, you let it play to the first side, and then you go and you turn it over. Well, before this, you probably lifted that needle up to just play your favorite song, but now you felt like one song was leading into another, and it was taking you kind of on a little musical journey, and that's called sequencing, and that became a huge part of how albums were put together. You wanted to create a certain mood, so you put maybe two fast songs together, and then you put a slow one. It wasn't just put who cares what order they're in. Doesn't matter. No one's listening. They're just moving the needle. Sgt. Pepper changed that. It was like, wait a minute, one song fits into another. And so you had a certain mindset of how you're listening to an album. And then the more you're listening, you're hearing different sounds. Why don't you play the second one there? Now, we all know how... Go to the next song after this one. Now, this... Okay... Who ever heard of a harpsichord in a rock song? And now listen to John Lennon's voice. That's not John Lennon's voice. That's not the John Lennon from Nowhere Man or Ticket to Ride. But what's he doing here? You're like, whoa, so this is the first I'm hearing of John Lennon on this album, and it doesn't even sound like John Lennon. And then the song, obviously, Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds, there's a lot of, I mean... John Lennon was a very clever guy. He was a very smart guy and very clever. Now, he always claims that Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds was a drawing that his son Julian made from school. There was a girl in school named Lucy, and he drew this picture of Lucy, his classmate, and she was floating in the air with stars, and that's how he came up with the idea. Now, we all know that the Beatles had been using drugs, and especially LSD, which was experimental at the time. It still was legal at that time. It wasn't even illegal at the time because it was such a new drug. But the Beatles had been, you know, especially Lennon, had been taking LSD since say, 66 or so. You cannot tell me that Lucy, L, in the sky, S, and D with diamonds does not mean LSD when you listen to the words. You know, kaleidoscope eyes, you know, cellophane taxis. What do we, you know, get, climb in the back with your head? You know. This is not some little kid's drawing. It's a nice story. I think they wanted to downplay the fact, but the fact of the matter was the Beatles were, through this album and through many of these songs, were letting everybody know what they were into. And once again, validation. There was a lot of experimental things going on with drugs. But don't forget, we didn't have any internet. So we didn't know that everybody was doing it or who was doing it. So the Beatles were saying, guess what? We're doing it. We're trying it. Maybe you want to, maybe you don't, but I'm just letting you know what we're doing. But that song was so different in its sound and, once again, in its presentation. It's almost like a Dalí kind of painting. I mean, you can almost see the dripping clock in there. You know, and he always credits the poet E.E. Cummings, who was very descriptive and very surreal in his writings, and even Lewis Carroll with Alice in Wonderland. And I mean, many people say that Alice in Wonderland was written on LSD. you know, I mean, let's face it, this little girl goes underneath, you know, there's even the classic thing of her, you know, sitting on the mushroom, smoking the hookah. It wasn't Skull, folks. So, right, once again, if you're 20 years old or 18 years old and you put this album on and now you're listening to these different songs and you're going, what the heck is going on? And then you cannot forget the cover. Up to this point, most album covers were just pictures of the artist. And once again, you can look at Revolver, which was the real first departure. If you know what the album of Revolver looks like, it's a sketch. It actually won a Grammy. It was written by one of their friends, Klaus Voormann, who they met in Germany, who wound up playing on a lot of their solo albums, especially John Lennon's. And it's a sketch of the Beatles, but it's very abstract, and it's you know, there's drawings and sketches as well as pictures. It's very avant-garde, especially for a group as mainstream as the Beatles were. But then with this album, they went to the nth degree. And here are the Beatles once again on the cover with the big bass drum of Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. They are not the Beatles. They are Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. And they've got their, you know, their mustaches, and they've got those bright little suits. And, you know, Lennon's got the little granny glasses. I mean, don't forget, before this, John Lennon always wore glasses, but he never wore glasses in public. If you'd see him on stage, he never wore glasses. And he always had those thick kind of Buddy Holly glasses. But he never wore glasses. Suddenly, and he was always round-faced, too. I mean, Lennon was always, actually, he even says about the movie Help, that was my Elvis period, because he was kind of chunky. He always had a round face, though. Suddenly, you hadn't seen John Lennon in a year. You wouldn't even recognize him. Not only does he have a mustache, but he's got these little granny glasses, which then started a trend. And they all got the long hair. So the Beatles come back, and they're not even the Beatles, per se. And then there's this crazy cover with all these people behind them, this conglomeration of personalities and pop culture and actresses and politicians. And you can just sit there and start to look at this album. Once again, we talk about album art. This is where it started, folks. So you've got this album playing, and then you've got this album cover, and then, let me pull out my Sgt. Pepper vinyl. And this is not just bought 2 days ago, folks. Okay? This is actually on Parlophone Records, whatever that is. That was one of their first, I don't know, this is an actual, you know, it's not necessarily an original. It's not like it's going to be worth a lot of money, but it certainly was, you know, bought at the time or near it. But you look at this, and you also have to remember, so not only do you have this crazy thing, and I mean, there's, you know, there's Marilyn Monroe, and there's Marlon Brando, and there's W.C. Fields, and, you know, there's Bob Dylan, and what, and there's Muhammad, or, you know, that's, or no, that's Sugar Ray Robinson. And it's like, what's going on here? Tony Curtis? And there's the Beatles. And then you have to remember that there was, you know, this is something that still goes on. There was a rumor that Paul McCartney died in a traffic accident, and that the Paul McCartney that then was not really Paul McCartney, was a double, because he was so, there's no way that that they would allow the Beatles to go on, you know. So they got a double to play Paul McCartney. And so I don't know if if this was just conspiracy theories or not, but certainly the Beatles played into it. The whole idea, as I said before, is that the Beatles wanted to be somebody else. If you look on the cover of Sgt. Pepper, right to the left of them, there's the old Beatles sort of looking down at what might be viewed as a funeral or a grave of the Beatles spelled in flowers. And they're sort of looking at that as the death of the old Beatles. Interestingly, there's a guitar that looks like Paul's Beatle bass. And so people said, well, that meant that Paul is dead and that the Beatles were mourning his death. And there's a little doll that says, welcome to the Rolling Stones. And the whole idea there was, well, with the Beatles gone now, the Rolling Stones will be the biggest group in rock and roll. So I don't know how much the Beatles played into this, but there were certainly people went crazy about the Paul is dead rumors based on this cover. So now you had this crazy looking cover. You had this music that was certainly different. And here was something else that we take for granted, never happened before. You turn the album over, the lyrics of the album are printed on the back. That had never happened before. They never printed the lyrics to the song. So now you had a chance to literally sing along and see what they were writing about. And it once again added some prestige that these were not just silly pop songs that would just come and go. Here's the lyrics. Learn the words. Here are the words. This is important music we're offering you. That was a huge change. Once again, you look at it now, you say, what's the big deal? It was a big deal back then. And that's what I'm talking about, context. The great thing is about that album and about this album is that, as I said, for its time, it was amazing and it was a breakthrough. But 50 years later, play the next one there, Kevin. 50 years later, there's still just some really good songs on this album. And this is one of my favorites. It's getting better all the time. I used to get mad at my school. Now, this is another great example of the Lennon McCartney. This is a Paul McCartney song, without a doubt. It's light and jumpy, and it's optimistic. It's Paul. It's getting better. And it can't get no worse. That's Lennon. So here's McCartney saying, oh, things are getting better. And Lennon's line is, well, it can't get no worse. And then listen, you know. I used to be an angry young man. Later, and he says, I used to be cruel to my woman. I beat her and kept her apart from the things that she loved. Whoa, where did, you know, that's not Paul McCartney, because he's nice and bouncy. But there's Lennon with the anti-McCartney, which gives this song a little edge, and it makes it interesting. So it's not just some silly love song, if you will. It's got some edge to it, and it really gives it something that you can grab onto. And, you know, what was so great about this is that then they were, the Beatles themselves, along with George Martin, who cannot be forgotten, the producer of this, they really decided that we wanted to really break the rules of not just the concept album. They wanted to break all the rules. They wanted to break rules for themselves as to who they were, and they wanted to break some rules about what music could sound like or what it should sound like. They were very, Paul McCartney especially, was very influenced by the Beach Boys' Pet Sounds album, which was a huge departure in 1966 for the Beach Boys and Brian Wilson. They were writing about beaches and cars and be true to your school and a lot of, you know, young teen fun things. And then Pet Sounds came in, and it was a very introspective and deep lyric album, and the arrangements of the songs, the chord structures, were much more mature. And McCartney heard Pet Sounds and said, uh-oh, wait a minute. We can't be writing three-minute little love songs anymore. Look at what Brian Wilson's doing. And that was a huge influence on Sgt. Pepper. And so when you look at it, you also have fun. There's songs, of course. Play the next one there. This is one that is being for the benefit of Mr. Kite. Literally, and it exists. John Lennon saw a poster for a carnival and wrote this song based on the carnival poster. All the things he mentions are all on that poster. And so once again, the ideas for of how to get a song It wasn't just before. It was, she loves you, I love you, you love me, I miss you. It was all speaking to girls. Suddenly, they were breaking rules. It wasn't just about themselves or speaking to the audience. They weren't teeny bopper idols anymore. They were looking around and finding inspiration from things around them. And then what's so cool about this song, later on, is there's this whirling organ. And what they did with that, don't forget, they're making this not digitally. This is all on tape. They recorded the solo and all those instruments, and the, if you listen, it kind of sounds a little disjointed. They took, they cut the tape, threw it on the floor, picked it up, and however they picked it up, they put it together, and that's that solo there. So that was the kind of thing. They were breaking rules. They were, there's no such thing as you can't do, and that's why Sgt. Pepper, again, was an important album, because there was things happening here musically, sonically. It was opening up the minds of producers and songwriters to say, hey, guys, expand your universe. Right here. So listen how it's all just disjointed. Because they just took the tape and edited it together and were able to get some kind of a melody out of it. And so that is actually one of the more famous songs from that, just because of its of what it is. And then obviously, I'm running out of time here, but the last one is one of their epics, obviously. A Day in the Life, which really is once again a couple of songs. Could you jump to The Day in the Life? And once again, the reprise comes. And so once again, this is the encore now. This is kind of the encore. The last song on the album is the encore. They had the reprise, and they said goodnight, and they came back for one more song. And what's so revolutionary about this song in many ways is, at least from the Beatles standpoint, is that it's really two songs in one. You know, Lennon, once again, he picked up a newspaper and was reading some of the headlines, and that's where a lot of these things he mentions in here. And then Paul McCartney said, well, you know, I've got this little bit that I don't know what to do with. And then that's that middle part where he says, woke up, roll out of bed, dragged a comb across my head. So once again, you've got this. What was so revolutionary about this is that here's this kind of somber, still kind of odd, surrealistic song from Lennon. And then in the middle of it, there's this bouncy little, little McCartney ditty. And once again, the key to this, and once again, the validation, the counterculture, the summer of love. This is really, don't forget, we're going to hear a lot about the summer of love, too, in 1967 when all the hippies went to San Francisco. Well, this is what kicked it off. Don't forget, June 1st, this is released. Within 2 or 3 weeks, there was a validation that it was summer, school was out, and there was something cool going on in San Francisco, music-wise, free love-wise, drug-wise, philosophy-wise. Before we go back to school, we're going to San Francisco. We're going to check out the scene there. And so here's the line. I'd love to turn you on. So once again, the Beatles are clearly talking about the drug culture and how they are a part of it. So you look back 50 years later, and you can read all this stuff. You know, and there's a lot of stuff on it now, and there's this huge remastered box set which the Beatles did participate in, and George Martin's son Giles produced it. George Martin passed away last year, but the key thing to remember is that it is worth making a big deal about. Even as bad as the Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band movie was with Peter Frampton and the Bee Gees, and I still have my double album soundtrack from that, you got to say that there's actually some really good Beatles covers on there, especially Aerosmith's Come Together and Earth, Wind & Fire's Got to Get You Into My Life. But as we look back at 50 years of Sgt. Pepper, if you really want to appreciate it, you can appreciate it for some really good Beatles songs. But if you really want to do it the right way, is do a little homework. Find out about what was going on in 1967 and find out. And then listen to this album and then say, wow, if I was 17 years old and I was feeling a little rebellious and Perry Como and Dean Martin and Frank Sinatra were the big stars of the day, and that's who my parents liked, and suddenly I bought this album and put it on and looked at it and opened it up and read the lyrics and looked at the cover, I would say, there's a new sheriff in town. And that's really what happened. It really ushered in a period of time. We look back at it on 50 years, and you can debate. A lot of people, as I said, have been saying how Revolver is their best album now in terms of songs and even maybe in terms of experimentation. But as I said before, at the end of the day, what you have to appreciate is Sgt. Pepper for being timely when it was put out, and the music is timeless. I don't know if I've done the album and that period justice. I don't know if I taught you anything, but it's always an album that I enjoy listening to. It does deserve to be celebrated after 50 years, and it will be around for another 5,000 years, probably, if we are. Even though they're not as cool as Led Zeppelin, Kevin. Although you got to love Houses of the Holies album, the album cover there.
Yeah, I mean, same concept.
Yeah,
the cover or everything.
Yeah,
you know.
Exactly. And that's the thing. So often, the stuff that started it gets forgotten, and so that's why it's important to take a step back. And Beatles fans will love Sgt. Pepper. And music fans will appreciate it. But for the average person, you should understand why we're making such a big deal about it. Because so much of who we are and what we are. I mean, don't forget, it's no coincidence that Steve Jobs chose Apple as the name of his company. Because Apple was the name of the Beatles company. And so if you're holding an iPhone right now, the guy who invented that was influenced by the Beatles. So, in fact, they go to court over the whole Apple thing. But you cannot deny the influence that it had, and yes, the songs are certainly among their best. But are they the best songs ever written? No. Like I said, to be honest with you, I could take probably Lovely Rita off and maybe When I'm 64 or maybe Fixin' a Hole, and I would put Penny Lane and Strawberry Fields on there. It might be even a better album than it is. But Sgt. Pepper, it was 50 years ago today that Sgt. Pepper taught the band to play, and hopefully I taught you a little bit about why this is such a great album. We got the little closeout music there? Yes, we do. So I hope you enjoyed my little Pepper podcast here. Elton Jim Toronto and Captain Podtastic. Every Monday a new episode is posted at WGNplus.com. I ain't here on business. I'm only here for fun. Hope you had a good time today. I certainly did. And don't forget, every Monday, the only podcast that comes from the end of the web to your screen.